Hi, this is Favi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are
Latinos Who Lunch,
the podcast where we talk about important things like
Mr. Sheffield.
Hello, hello, hello.
Kishol, kishol, kishol.
How's it going, Babelito? How are you?
I'm good. Baking because I turned off the AC and I'm also in the middle of the desert, but I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Also in the middle of the desert in a beautiful air-conditioned apartment or a studio. I'm in my art studio right now.
Nice, nice.
What desert are you in?
I am now officially a resident for the rest of the year in Yucca Valley, which is next to Joshua Tree National Park, which is gorgeous, by the way. It's
come on, Yucca.
Right. It's interesting. There's like yesterday we found this bug. Ay, hijo de la chingada, se me olvidó el nombre. Pero like they lift up their butt to threaten you. And if you bother them, the way they attack is they basically fart. And it smells horribly.
Yeah.
It doesn't go away. So that's the kind of shit I've been learning lately.
The Babelito bug.
That's...
Yeah, cool, cool, cool.
Speaking
You're
of...
finally one with nature.
Ooh, you, you. Yes. I know. We're like,
oh man, I miss making fun of you. This is so fun.
Ay, qué suave. Qué bueno por ti. Oh yeah. What you've been eating?
Oigo.
What's going on? What?
Oh, bitch. Today, let me tell you, I ate como un rey because I don't know. You know, I've been trying to just like meal prep so that I don't have to worry about it and stress out about food all the time and, you know, save money, this and that. And also, but I'm also thinking like there's so many businesses that are kind of going under all over the United States because
yeah.
The government doesn't care about us, you know, especially like Latinx, POC, black people, right? So I decided that I'm going to like at least once a week spend some money at my favorite local spot. Or not even my favorite, just like a spot that I think, you know, would benefit from my business. Not that I'm like over here, Ben de la Christ or whatever, but I think that, I don't know, I just, you know, my guilty pleasure is like eating shitty fast food. And I don't know, I just don't feel great about that anymore because I'm like, no matter what happens, like McDonald's and Burger King and all that bullshit, they're going to be around after this pandemic, but...
True.
A lot of the restaurants that we love here in Las Vegas are not. And so today, you know, it was one of those days where I was just like really wasn't hungry at breakfast. So I just like whatever, had some fruit or something. I don't know. And then for lunch, I'm like, I'm going to be starving for lunch because I know I didn't eat a lot for breakfast, which is usually my jush, you know?
Yeah.
And so... I went to this little cafe right here by my studio. I'm going to give them a shout out. Fuck it. It's called Esmeraldas, and it's like this like half Guatemalan, half Salvadoran lady who's – she's old friends with my family. Something happened, probably some religious shit back in the day, and they, you know,
ya no se hablan,
pero, but they're polite when they see each other, and maybe like once a year my family will go eat a big meal there just to like support Los Paisas, you know?
Right, right.
Today I'm like, yeah, you know what I want? I want a fucking un desayuno típico de Centroamérica, you know, like plátanos, fritos, crema, frijoles.
Yes.
Huevo con like con un pan o con like tortillas hechas a mano, you know?
Uh-huh.
Like I was talking about my mom makes them. And so that's what I had. And then I was there and I was like, you know what, señora? Ya que estoy aquí, like, load it up, bitch. I was like, give me four. I was like, deme cuatro de cada pupusa. And they're like, what do you mean? And I'm like, cuatro de frijol con queso, cuatro de loroco con queso, cuatro revuelta. I was like, just give me all of it. And I'm just going to put, that's just like what I'll eat for lunch this week.
Para
like pupusas.
Yeah,
because, you know, pupusas, you could just put them in the fridge. You can even freeze them and then just like put them in the microwave, right?
Yeah.
If you want, if you're like that. Girl, did you see 7-Eleven is selling pupusas now?
No mames. The end
is near. The end is near. You're not on TikTok, but I saw images of the 7-Eleven pupusas and their wrappers, and there's this sound that people use on TikTok when there's like weird like conspiracy theory alien shit.
Yeah.
It's like la la la. La 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 la. It's like really scary. Uh-huh. Like stupid.
Y lo que están haciendo con las pupusas.
That's what I saw when I saw the 7-Eleven pupusas. I was like, that's it. Yeah. Ya viene Cristo.
Sí, ya.
It's the end.
Para eso me vine al desierto, güey, para entregarme.
Yeah, bitch, just like, just hold your heart, just, yeah, encomiéndate.
Así dice mi cuñada, no, ya mejor me entrego, ya qué. Ay, no, qué pedo.
Oh, so that's what I ate. How about you?
I had a very bougie breakfast because I'm on the run. Mondays, you know what, like, before we recorded, like, I took, like, a quick nap because I open my calendar and I get so overwhelmed. And I know it's like a matter of just tackling everything and doing the work, but I got so anxious and I'm just like, oh, but I just had, I like when I get overwhelmed like that, como que me duele el estómago y everything, you know, like it just gives me anxiety. So like, I couldn't even finish my coffee, but I just had toast with cream cheese. And el fin de semana, not fin de semana, like for a night, we went to go see my dad because it was his 65th and birthday. Shout out to my dad.
Come on, retired. Is he getting his social security now?
Dude, I've been trying to convince them to be in the podcast, pero no se dejan. They have the funniest, like, they have these stories about when they cross the border. And they're fucking funny, which, like, it's like the opposite of, like, the narratives that we used to. I'm like, we gotta talk about it. We gotta talk about it. Pero mi mamá dice, ay no, qué vergüenza, cómo, like, she won't do it. But anyway, so when we left,
you know, you gotta respect it. Some people just don't want to talk about that shit. I mean, it's funny to us and familia, but
right.
They don't want their business out there. No, that's what my mom said. She's like, you better stop talking about me.
Ay, a mi mamá le encanta, güey. Now I tell her that I'm always
shout out to you, Clement. Para los mejores tacos en Las Vegas.
We were talking about pozole, and I did it in front of her because she is very proud of her pozole. Y se estaba sacando la ceja ella, and like my husband and I were just talking, and he's like, yeah, your pozole is really good. And I'm like, yeah, I know, like, it's my pozole is really good. And she wasn't included in the conversation, and she was just, she kept, you know, like, pulling her eyebrows. She goes, sí, a mí también me sale bien rico el pozole. Like,
just dropping hints.
Yeah, just like include me in this conversation. But while we were gone, mi suegra y mi suegro se quedaron aquí en la casa because it was their anniversary. So they're like, mi suegra, Rosa Mamá, is like, te tengo una propuesta indecorosa. ¿Qué tal si me dejas tu departamento when you guys go? So they left, and of course we came back. There was mole, and they left lox, which I haven't had since I used to work for a big corporation that makes fake bagels. And that's what I had. I had lox, cream cheese,
Einstein bagels. Where did you work?
I fuck it. I work for Einstein's Bagels, pero
you did?
Stupid.
I cannot see you at a real job. Oh my God, that's crazy.
You know what? That's how I learned the names of ingredients. I was like, scallions? Oh. Like, what is scallions?
Qué escándalo, scallions.
Que somos scallions. So that's how, that was my...
Bitch, can I tell you? Okay.
Go for it.
This past week, I did a TikTok recipe.
Uh-huh.
I never thought I would get down to that, but there's this, like, cute little gay twink on TikTok that does, like, Italian food.
Yeah.
And he did this cabbage dish that was really easy, and I was like, oh my God, I can do that. I just got to go get the, like, five ingredients. And one of them was scallions. And I was at the grocery store, like, pulling my hair. And I was like, what the fuck is a scallion?
Son cebollas, like, verdes, güey.
Son cebollas. I'm like, bitch, this, you can't say green. You know these people that are, like, they use a different word just so it sounds fancier?
Yeah.
You could have just said, las cebollas para la carne asada, like, and I would have been like, oh, I know what it is, you know? And I'm like, anyway, it was the first time I've ever cooked with alcohol. It called for, like, a bottle of wine to, like, bake it. Like when you bake it, you put the wine on it.
Pues quisiste, I've never.
It's just like a cabbage dish that you like sear the cabbage with all these vegetables, and then you throw it in the oven and you broil it. But you mix in like broth and wine and stuff. It's really good.
Oh wow! Yeah, like
I got really fancy, you know. Like I used an oven, like real white people shit. I used an oven, girl. I took out all the pots and pans out of my oven because you know a Latinx oven is a storage unit. Okay, you got everything.
Cuando se
los biles, you got it.
Cuando se descompone la washing machine, like the dishwasher. That's what you keep all your like.
No, girl, we take it to the living room and we put the TV on top of it so you can see it better. So it's higher. Girl, I remember, I think we've talked about this on the show, but when I was a kid, we had like a 1960s like giant TV console, like a black and white TV that broke.
Same.
And we just kept it and then put a big TV on top of that. Encima. And then when that broke, we put another TV on top of that.
La pinche torre de Babel de televisiones.
Yeah, we just had like three TV. Only the one on the top worked. I'm like, I don't know if we can. We can't do it. We can't do it again. The TV's gonna hit the roof. Anyway, I had a lot of neck pain from watching TV as a kid. But back to you in living your white woman fantasy in Joshua Tree.
Oh my God, you have no idea. It's like
or in Yucca Valley. Sorry,
it's so. I'm so far away from Chicago, which feels very nice. But I know. Once it's time to go back, that's when it's going to be so difficult. But I don't want to think
Wait, why were
that.
You talking about scallions?
Oh, because of...
locks. Back.
Yes. So
okay,
that's
you
I
used
had.
To work at Einstein's Bagels. That's where you learned the ropes. And that's actually when you started to make your transformation to full-on white bruja.
Así es.
Because, right?
When you start putting sprouts in your sandwiches... That's when you know you did. Ya es muy tarde, güey. Ya, como te digo, ya te tienes like, que entregar. You're like, fuck it. Christ is
you're
coming.
Putting alfalfa on shit. Like, wait, I thought this was for cows. Okay, here we go.
Speaking about white people doing Mexican shit.
Yes.
We have a really interesting interview today. So,
oh, yes.
Yeah, we have Professor of Spanish and Latin American Studies, Ignacio Sanchez Prado. And he's going to talk to, I had an interview with him like a month or so ago. And he talked about Diana Kennedy, the legacy of Diana Kennedy and also Rick Bayless, which to me was a really interesting interview because he put things in a different context and in a different perspective. And I don't know, like, I want you to listen to it and send us your letters and your emails to see what you think. And I also want to know what you think, Fabi. So why don't we take a break and then we go to the interview and then we can talk a little bit more about our interview with Ignacio Sanchez.
Awesome. OMG, babs.
Qué show.
It's that time of year. It's our month, Latinx Heritage Month.
Y qué mejor manera de celebrarlo than with our coloring book, The ABCs of Latinidad.
From Ajax to Zacatecas, we cover it all.
¿Qué cuál es la B? Barroquismo. ¿Qué cuál es la
¿Cuál
A?
¿Cuál es la C? Come mierda. No, that's not it.
My favorite is la W, güey.
¿Es qué?
Es la W. Es WhatsApp.
WhatsApp. Oh, that was like a real conversation my mom and I had, which was really funny. And it was like right before coronavirus, so it was very... It's kind of spooky to see it in the book because we, you know, that book came out in May, but we did the design for it like in January.
Right.
So it was weird. It was like telling the future. So if you want a piece of the past and the future, you can go to latinoswholunch.com/coloringbook and order it from a local bookstore here in Las Vegas. Shout out to our friends at the Writer's Block who are now fulfilling the book orders. I'm just like, I never thought I would have a book for sale in like a legit awesome bookstore. So it's so cool. So if you live in the Las Vegas area and you're careful and you have a mask and you want to go out and like see a really cool bookstore, I recommend going to the Writer's Block. They have so many amazing cool books and gift ideas, and it's just a really fun place. And of course, while you're there, pick up a few copies of Latinos Who Lunch, The ABCs of Latinidad.
Y apúrenle, cabrones, que se acaba rápido.
Okay.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. Babelito here. I am talking from my home in Chicago, which will not be my home, but that's a whole entire different topic. Right now, we have a very special guest. We have with us Ignacio, Dr. Ignacio Sanchez Prado. He is a professor of Spanish, Latin American Studies, and Film and Media Studies at the Washington University in St. Louis. And I invited him because it's actually a very interesting story. I had a wonderful seminar, a graduate seminar on landscape that happened basically a year ago. And in that seminar, we touch on ideas about traveling and authenticity, the expectation of travelers when they arrive to places like Mexico, but not only from the perspective of today, but we went back to the first journals of Christopher Columbus, all the way to the way that landscape is portrayed in traveling pages in Instagram. So we did that whole entire thing. So a recurring theme in the class was authenticity. And flash forward to a couple of weeks ago, my student put me in contact with Ignacio. And Ignacio was kind enough to share an article with me, Diana Kennedy, Rick Bailey's, and the Imagination of Authentic Mexican Food, which was published by the Bulletin of Spanish Studies. And I am fascinated by this topic. You know, Fabi and I have talked about the problems behind figures like Rick Bailey's, which famously complained about being discriminated for being white, which is a whole nother thing. But I think we're going to talk a little bit about that, about the expectations of authenticity in Mexican food. And we'll get into other topics. Ignacio, bienvenido. Muchísimas gracias. How are you?
Good. Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. Again, thank you so much for agreeing to this interview. It's just sometimes when your students are so engaged in the manner they are actually connecting you with future colleagues, it's very, 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 very rewarding. So again, thank you so much. But in the tradition of Latinos who lunch, I want to know what you had for lunch today.
So I had Korean tacos. We have, this comes from Los Angeles, but here in St. Louis, we have a very successful business called Seoul Taco.
Uh-huh.
That does these hybrid Mexican-Korean dishes. I think that is one of the great discoveries of American food of recent years. And yeah, that's what I had. I went to pick them up right before this podcast.
Oh, excellent. Actually, we just talked about in the podcast about Korean food. I was just saying how Korean food is one of those few foods that I can sit down and eat and not have 1,000 condiments because it's so well seasoned. And I'm so thankful for Koreans for that, because there's every time I order food, I have to have packages of like 1,000 little things. But with Korean food, it's precise and it is what it is.
Yes.
So why don't you tell us a little bit more about yourself? So I introduced you as part of the University of Washington in St. Louis, but tell me a little bit more about what you do, because I understand that you have several projects running at the same time, and we can talk about a little bit about all of them.
So I was born in Mexico City, where I lived for my first 18 years. Mm-hmm. Then I got my undergraduate degree at the University of the Americas in Puebla, Mexico, where I studied comparative literature.
Correct.
This led for me to get a PhD at the University of Pittsburgh in Latin American Literary Studies.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been working for Washington University since 2006 when I graduated from my degree.
Oh, wow.
And basically, I began as a researcher of literature. And then I spent many, many years working, and I still do, working on Mexican cinema. Mm-hmm. Around the time where González Iñárritu and Alfonso Cuarón were beginning to be famous, that's when I started researching on that.
Right.
And most recently, I'm a food enthusiast, but it has recently become an academic research project. And it's something that this is the article that you mentioned is my first publication on it. But mm-hmm. I think that it is a window to see a lot of the questions that interest me, you know, ideology, class, social difference, inequality, neoliberalism, so... I've been moving into that direction with food, but those are questions that I basically address in all of my research projects.
So you have several edited anthologies on Mexican literature, history of Mexican literature, and also one that I know we're going to talk about this maybe off camera because we're doing a Zoom interview off the microphone, but on emotions and sentimentality. Mm-hmm. Sentimentality is a project that I've been working on for several years. And to be honest, you're the first Mexican scholar that I saw that it's focusing on that. So I think we have a lot to talk about, which is very, very exciting. So I wanted to talk a little bit about Diana Kennedy and Rick Bayliss. Tell me a little bit more about who they are and why they have become from the flag of Mexican food in the United States to almost these villains in the past, I'm going to say 5 years, there's been a transformation on their public persona, not necessarily in the eyes of everybody, but they definitely have changed.
I think that in order to foreground that answer, I think that we have to understand a difference of perception about who speaks for your culture that I think takes place differently in Mexico and in the United States because of different histories.
Correct.
Cultural histories. In Mexico, Mexico is a country that has been historically very welcoming to foreigners.
Yes.
And if you see the, or at least to, you know, European and American foreigners, that's not the case necessarily with working class immigrants. We have to say that, of course.
Yes, yes, yes.
Out loud, right? But if you look from the, just even from the Mexican Revolution forward, in all the major genres of Mexican culture, painting, cinema, gastronomy, there's always a very significant participation of visitors and expats in the development of that culture.
Right.
And I think that if you, in Mexico, we feel not only a certain level of thankful, being thankful to them, because sometimes they look into things that people in Mexico immersed in the culture don't really notice, right?
Right.
But also because some of the way in which Mexico understands itself as a mestizo country, where cultural mixture is defining, is very different from the United States, where a racial segregation is very stark. Right. And cultural segregation. Mm-hmm. So in the context of American racial relations, what has happened in the past few years, but it's a long-standing current, is that one of the anti-segregation demands has been to have people of color and marginalized communities to speak about themselves and to carry the leading voice about speaking about themselves.
Right.
And sometimes that means deplatforming people from other communities, especially dominant communities, white communities, who have in the past been representatives and advocates for those minority cultures. And I think that as someone that lives in both worlds, right, I consider myself more to be Mexican because of my origin. I'm technically Mexican-American because I'm a U.S. citizen, but I have lived almost exactly the same amount of time in both countries at this point. I can see the back and forth, and I can see the goods and the bads of both. I don't have a strong inclination for either one of them.
Yeah.
So that's how we have to understand that. I think that the pushback that you're feeling is mostly one that is felt by the Mexican American community.
Yes.
And it is not really felt in Mexico as such.
Uh-huh.
And they are very different cases. Diana Kennedy is this British woman who arrived in Mexico back in the 1960s because her husband was a diplomat. In doing that, she started learning how to cook Mexican food and became a very big enthusiast and an amateur about it. And she is an amateur. And what she has been doing for many, many years is collecting recipes across Mexico.
Right.
From all regions. She has traveled miles and miles and miles, and she has collected, she has the biggest collection of Mexican cookbooks that anyone has, and she just donated those to the University of Texas in San Antonio for open access. And, you know, one thing that you have to say about her is that when in Mexico, a lot of people were not paying attention to some of the things that she did pay attention to. Mm-hmm. She ended up having the collection of cookbooks because not very many people were actually collecting them. They were getting lost. And she also is a very big advocate of biodiversity. So she has been very important in the preservation of native species. She has worked with the Mexican government on environmental issues. Mm-hmm. The thing that I think is the wealth and the problem of her approach is that she writes these cookbooks and she always credits the recipe to the person that actually she got the recipe from. And it's usually señoras from all over Mexico. Mostly, it's mostly people from households, right? She used to go to houses, ask people to cook for them, get the recipe from them, collect them. And I think that the ambiguous question, and people have different feelings about this, is you can say that she has profited professionally from this collecting of stories, and the how much retribution goes back to the people who develop these things is certainly a question mark. On the other hand, it is also true that there's a lot of knowledge that we have about working class Mexican cooking and domestic Mexican cooking, because if Diana Kennedy had not collected it, we would not have it. And I believe that the loss of that knowledge would have been catastrophic, because a lot of the things that you see, especially in his cookbooks from the 1970s, it has been disappearing over time because of the industrialization of Mexican food after NAFTA. Mm-hmm. Rick Bayless is a more complicated case, I would say. He's trained as a linguistic anthropologist.
Oh, I did not know that.
And with that training, and he had enthusiasm about Mexican food. He even had a show out of the blue on Mexican cooking back in the 70s in PBS.
Oh, wow.
But really, where he became actually Rick Bayless is that he used to go to Mexico and use his skills as a linguistic anthropologist to interview people. And Diana Kay used to do it more in houses, but Rick Bayless did it more in like mercados and fondas and more public places.
So it's almost like gendering the practices of food anthropology.
Absolutely, because uh-huh. if you see the self-fashioning, Diana Kennedy presents herself as like a very knowledgeable amateur, and Rick Bayless is a chef, right?
Yeah, so but it's very interesting because we have Diana Kennedy's like the domestic female figure and Rick Bayless in the outdoors.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And you know, Rick Bayless, people have more stronger feelings about him, I guess, than Diana Kennedy. I think Diana Kennedy, yeah. even some of her detractors recognize her contributions. Rick Bayless has made a lot more money out of Mexican food. That is unquestionable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that there, he has an important contribution that I'm willing to defend. As a consequence of culinary racism in the United States, Mexican food gets reduced to street food.
Right.
A lot of Mexican entrepreneurs who seek to open the restaurant, they're unable to monetize it because there's a lot of expectations of being cheap. And if you look at the development of Mexican restaurants in the United States, particularly outside of California, Rick Bayless is the person that put in the Midwest, for example, the notion that you have to pay money for Mexican food. The notion that
right.
it is not cheap. The notion that you do not have to go buy the cheapest garbage chips, but you can actually buy chips made with heirloom corn from that, you know, you can garden Hoja Santa in your garden rather than just substituting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that over time, his contribution, for which he's no victim, I mean, he has made plenty of money out of it. But his contribution is that he has really been significant in diversifying the concept of Mexican food outside of the Mexican community, which I think in turn has enabled a next generation of chefs to open higher end restaurants of Mexican food and actually have people that, because they went with Rick Bayless first, then they go and try those restaurants. I think that if you look at the history of food from any period, it's always hybrid and it is always a history of creative appropriation.
Yes.
And I don't think that the current language of communities have to speak to about themselves only or mostly really is a good framework to understand all the complexities of that underlying food practices.
Correct. It's very interesting because I noticed that I did my undergrad and I lived for many years in Las Vegas. And we saw that shift. We saw that shift, I'm going to say 10 years ago, where we went from Taco Bell's to Chipotle to all of a sudden, quote unquote, fine dining, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the Strip, for instance, which became a culinary mecca for, the Strip of Las Vegas became a culinary mecca for celebrity chefs. They mm-hmm. were not embracing Mexican food because still mm-hmm. the perception 15 years ago or so was that it was, as you said, it was cheap. There was a shift. There was a shift on that. And I think it partly has a lot to do with the fact that in the celebrity chef world kingdom, Mexican food started to become a little bit more prominent outside of tacos and tortas and, mm-hmm. and tea. And you're right. It was as much as I dislike him, it was Rick Bayless that started that.
But I think we have to understand in these debates, I think that whenever we go to the notion of authentic Mexican food, which Rick Bayless and Diana Kennedy both do, I think we're tackling it wrong.
Right.
The notion of authentic Mexican food, as far as I read it, is a notion that is disparaging to Mexican-American entrepreneurs, because Tex-Mex food, Cal-Mex food, that's the food of immigrant communities that did changes to the stuff that was in Mexico for simple things, like adapting themselves to ingredient availability as well as the taste of the communities in which to which they were immigrating. So I don't think you can go out and say, like Diana Kennedy does, that a dish of fajitas with rice and beans is an unworthy dish, because that entails a disparaging of the migrant community. Authenticity, exactly. Authenticity is a concept that polices the identity of people, right. And it can really reproduce inequalities unwittingly. Mm-hmm. I think that what you have to see, for me, is what is the infrastructure of food justice that an economic system provides. So what would be the contribution of someone like Rick Bayless there? Well, if you look at tortillas, for example, most places that are available to us, supermarkets, they sell Maseca.
Right.
And Maseca is a corporation that has grown enormously due to NAFTA. It has a very, very problematic relationship to the environment, to peasant communities, and also to health, because the tortilla from Maseca is not as nutritious as a traditional tortilla. That is almost impossible to find.
And that shift from almost homemade tortillas to the Maseca in the Mexican household happened when? And it was like
It starts happening in the 80s, but I think it's really during NAFTA. And there's two excellent mm-hmm. books about this. One is Eating NAFTA by Alicia Galvez. Mm-hmm. And the other one called is The Neoliberal Diet by Gerardo Otero. Mm-hmm. And basically, if you track that, the change to Maseca tortillas and to other industrialized foods in Mexico is tied to the rise of obesity and diabetes in Mexican culture. So if you look at people like Rick Bayless, but also Enrique Olvera, the chef of Puyol, who also has some outputs in the United States, if you look at Gabriela Cámara, who's in both countries, if you look at, you know, even white-owned Mexican restaurants, we have one here called Mission Taco. An interesting thing about them is that they source their corn differently. Mm-hmm. Some of them are Mexican, some of them are not. But really, the important thing is that they get heirloom corn from peasant communities in Mexico, mostly from Oaxaca. Rick Bayless even has a line of the Frontera chips that comes from that corn. Mm. And the reason why that's important is because people are making money here. So we don't have, this is not like a non-profit or like an NGO. This is a business. But it does create a business infrastructure that allows peasants in Mexico to make money out of heirloom corn, which in turn allows them to resist the push for transgenic and GMO corn. Mm-hmm. And it also allows people like us to have sustainable sources of high quality Mexican ingredients that are not cheap, but not unaffordable, in order for us to not necessarily default to transnational corporate brands. It's not big enough for it to be available to everyone, but I think that if you create an economy for it to exist, then in the future you can envision a predominance of heirloom corn and not of Monsanto corn in the tortilla market. So people like Rick Bayless, by creating an economy for Mexican ingredients, they also contribute to the Mexican economy and to the economy of Mexican communities.
So what is the pushback then? If we have some of all of this positive ideas and things that both chefs and several chefs are doing, what is the pushback? And you can tell me and then I can add to the conversation.
So the pushback for me comes from two different places. Uh-huh. The first one is the representation matter, right? Mm. Rick Bayless is the visible face of a food chain. Of a food way, as is Diana Kennedy. And I don't think people necessarily see the underlying infrastructure. What they see is a white chef from Oklahoma making money out of Mexican food.
Right.
And then they come and wonder why isn't a Mexican chef making the money. But then it is true, if you were to start tracking the practices of different restaurants and chefs, you will find Mexican chefs that do very questionable stuff, because ethics is not a matter of being white or Mexican. Ethics is a matter of your economic practices. Right. And I think that for me, the litmus test, and that you have to apply to everyone, is not whether you have the right to cook Mexican food or not. It is more about, is the economy that you are constructing something that helps or hurts communities? That's really the question. Right. And the answer is not always going to be clean. It might be that Rick Bayless like takes over space from Mexican restaurateurs in Chicago, but mm-hmm. he also favors peasant communities back in Oaxaca that other Mexican chefs in the United States don't. So you have to really analyze exactly what is the whole chain of supply, for instance, of the restaurants to understand its social effect.
In terms of representation, that's very interesting, because the answer to Rick Bayless and Diana Kennedy, and you mentioned in your article, was Patty. What was her last name? Uh-huh. And what was the second? What was the second chef that you mentioned?
There's a few. Marcela Valladolid is another example. Mm-hmm. Now we see Gabriela Cámara coming to the U.S. She has a very successful business in Mexico. Now she's starting to operate in California. Mm-hmm. Enrique Olvera, the chef from Puyol, which is the highest ranking restaurant in the Americas or in North America. He is based in Mexico City. He has a New York outpost. He's now opening an outpost in Los Angeles. I think that you have to understand that whenever there's a white chef deploying his privilege to diversify the image that a community has outside of the community, this opens in as an effect the possibility for that community to thrive. That is the difference between, let's say, Rick Bayless and Glenn Bell, the founder of Taco Bell. Taco Bell stole an idea of a taco, and then it became itself the idea of the taco in the United States and globally. Like, if you go to Norway and you see tacos, you will see Taco Bell tacos. But it didn't give back to the community anything. It's a thoroughly exploitative business. Rick Bayless, we might have objections with some elements of his persona, his narrative of Mexican food, but Rick Bayless creates an economy that traces back to Mexico, and he also has enabled Mexican restaurateurs to have a space in which they can sell Mexican high cuisine and not only low profit street food, where they expect you to get the chips for free, right? And things like that. That, you know, in some communities they have to do this but I don't think it's ideal. I think that Mexican entrepreneurs of all levels should be able to profit from their work. And in order to create that profit, you have to break prejudice.
Right. And I think the pushback, it comes from the way, and you talk about it in your article a little bit, it comes in the ways which they offer the notion of authenticity.
Yes.
And it becomes very problematic for a lot of people. Can you talk about more about this, about what is that drive for us to feel authenticated, especially when it comes to notions of food and more specifically Mexican food?
You know, I'm a transnational Mexican. I'm a Mexico-US dual citizen. I just ate Korean tacos. I don't think authenticity is a value.
Right.
I think authenticity is an ideology, because if you talk, what is Mexican food? Mexican food is a very diverse product of various regions in Mexico, plus the migrant communities in the United States and elsewhere. You cannot just go and say that because the Oaxacan food has more indigenous connections, it is inherently superior to the food of Mexican Americans in California, which is what some of this authenticity discourse entails, right? And then whenever you start getting on that race of authenticity, that's how you can start invalidating people, because then you can absolutely ask, well, who is Diana Kennedy to speak about authentic Mexicanness? And the answer to that question is like, no one. Diana Kennedy is knowledgeable about traditions, but traditions have historical mobility too.
And they're so also they're also contingent to regions, which you talk about as well.
Absolutely. And I think that what happened with Diana Kennedy is because Diana Kennedy is very orthodox in her approach. So she says that the recipes that she collects has to be cooked as such. Like, she doesn't recognize she doesn't think historical mobility is positive on the one hand. Rick Bayless calls himself a translator in his books, if you read them carefully. So he says that he wants to translate an authentic experience, but you have to adapt to the instruments and to the ingredients that are available to you. neither one of those things constitutes authenticity. Anakin is recording, and Rick Bayless is translating, both of which are meritorious work. But whenever you say that I'm cooking authentic, you're also saying I'm speaking for this culture, and then you can get the pushback. I just think they're mischaracterizing their own work.
Right. And I think they're also intermediators for a lot of people that I think there's a wonderful essay by Persephone Braham, Adventures mm-hmm. in the Picturesque, Voyage and Voyeurism in the Tourist Guidebooks to Mexico. Mm-hmm. As I was reading your article, I kept thinking about this because in this essay, the author talks about ideas of authenticity in traveling and how mm-hmm. Guidebooks are going to they're the intermediators between a safe and authentic experience onto these places in Mexico. And if you somehow cross the boundaries, if you go off the beaten path, which is so popular to say, but somehow you experience something that you didn't expect that goes beyond your fantasies and it becomes dangerous, then trauma is created. And in a way, I thought about Mexican food in a very similar ways in our perceptions of authenticity, especially coming from white communities, because they have this fantasy, the Taco Bell fantasy of what Mexican food is. And then you have an intermediator that is white and it's safe for them. So they are able to now create different fantasies and ideas about what Mexico is through the food, and they're mm-hmm. able to consume it. But once again, safe enough, not too spicy, because otherwise I won't consume that. Just like mm-hmm. I don't want my experience to be dangerous, so I do not create. And she talks about, the author that I mentioned, talks about trauma, that once you cross that line from your fantasy of what you're going to see, and here I'm talking about what you're going to consume, to what you actually going to you experience, if you cross that path and it becomes dangerous, trauma is created. And that's when stereotypes are reinforced, et cetera, et cetera. And I really do think that that's one of the problems, yet one of the successes of people like Diana Kennedy mm-hmm. and Rick Bayless, is because they bring the exotic to the realm of the consumable for a lot of white audiences. And even Latinos that are a little bit more separated from the realities of places like Mexico and Latin America.
I mean, there's a couple of ways in which you can see that. So the idea of Mexicanness is a political construction.
Correct.
And in the case of Mexico, this was deliberate because it resulted from the revolution and from the construction of a state. So it was about creating an identity for a citizenry that for many, many years was divided by regions.
Right.
And if you talk to a Yucateco, colleague Igor Ayora, they do not identify with a lot of these ideas of Mexicanness.
Exactly. Because
Yucatan was even an independent republic for a few years.
Yucatan reminds me of Texas. Like they have like their own, yeah, complicated.
And then there's also a diplomatic function, which was, we're going to create all of these ideas of Mexico as a great country for foreign eyes.
Right.
This is a project not only of tourism. Tourism is sort of a second step. But it was also back in the 1920s and 30s, the idea that most people in Europe and the United States believed that Latin Americans were inferior. And it was a way of talking back at that inferiority by telling you, look, we have the pyramids, we have the murals, right? We have mole, right? And then in the case of the immigrant community in the United States, that's the third use, and that's why it matters so much for Chicanos and Mexican Americans. If you have faced racism in your community, and if you have faced the effect of white supremacy in the flesh, the idea that that it is important to be proud to be Mexican, which is central for the Chicano movement, for example.
Right.
And the idea of emphasizing, you know, La Virgen de Guadalupe, the authenticity of Mexican food, all of those things are mechanisms by which these communities push back against racism. Now, what we have, if you take a step back from that, like from believing in these things, and you look at everyday life, the problem there is that we all are hybrid subjects, right? No one lives like in a bubble of absolute Mexicanness and only consumes. if you go to a street food site in Mexico City, you will see the person making tacos al pastor, and next door there will be someone flipping burgers and hot dogs.
Right, right.
And the burgers and hot dogs are Mexicanized the way in which Mexican food is Americanized. So I think that you can absolutely say that people like safety too much, but we also like safety. How many Mexicans do you know that go to a Sichuan restaurant and they don't think it's exotic, right? Wow. Or how many or a Korean restaurant is with them? We're all comfortable in our own culture.
Yeah,
the reason why we penalize white Americans for being comfortable is because they occupy a position of dominance and power.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not. I know many Mexicans that would never eat certain kinds of Chinese food because they think it's too weird.
Yeah, and that's the thing, that the way that we perform race amongst each other is just not one way. And that's one of the things that we talked about in the podcast, that we think that a lot of people think that by being Latino by default exempts you from these problems, when
absolutely not.
That this is a problem that runs in all kinds of different communities and is contingent to class many times.
Mm-hmm.
Not many times, most of the times, especially in Latin America. And in Mexico, we talked about how it's kind of like residue of the colonial casta system. And when I think about the construction, which I think Carlos Monsiváis mentioned, not one of my favorites, but he talks about how Mexico was created by the gringos, or the idea of Mexico was created by the gringos. I'm working right now on Alexander von Humboldt, and mm-hmm. I'm hoping to have a whole episode just on von Humboldt, but how once he's given authority in the late 1700s to visit Mexico, to visit Latin America, especially South America, he begins this construction mm-hmm. of Mexico and Latin America in the foreign eyes, and in a way makes those fantasies created by chroniclers, by Columbus, by Cortes, by other chroniclers in the 16th, even 17th century, he renders them scientific, because it's part of the Enlightenment, and mm-hmm. it really starts this way of giving these foreigners a lot more authority than perhaps it that continues to this day. But what I like about this conversation is that, just like everything, the problems are not black and white. They're so much more complicated, and there's so many different levels to those ideas, and they're contingent to history all the time. And that's a problem I have in class. For instance, I have students that said, I'm not going to read this because it's not a Mexican author. I said, well, then you need to study harder so you can become that Mexican author that you're not finding out there. But right now, mm-hmm. we everybody's contributing to the conversation, and that's the reality, you know?
I had that conversation with some of my students. What you said about your student who wouldn't read Humboldt, that saddens me. And this is how I put it to my students. And they actually found it very productive when I had this conversation with my Mexican students. The problem that we have in terms of culture is that there's cultural injustice.
Right.
In the sense that there's people who say there's superior culture, inferior culture, there are appropriations and, you know, inequities of all kinds. And what I ask them is, what does it look like to have cultural justice? One version of this, which is the one that is derived from this idea that I only read Mexican authors, right, is Mexicans read Mexican culture, African-Americans, African-American culture, you know, Native American cultures, and white people, white culture. And if you think about it, if that was the final outcome, that's a culture of inequality.
Right.
It's everybody in their place, right? It's a segregational model. Mm-hmm. Everybody's in their place. That's exactly what segregationists want, right? Separate and equal. That's segregation.
Right.
So the way to fight about this is you have to understand two things. One is that Mexican knowledge, whatever that is, whatever we define as the knowledge of Mexico and Mexicans,
right,
is something that has to be equal and integrated to knowledge without adjective.
Mm.
That if you are gonna if you are gonna speak of cuisine, you are not just gonna speak of French cuisine. You are gonna recognize that Mexico, like China, like India, like Thailand, like Korea, they have incredibly rich traditions of cuisine that are informed by the others. But the French cuisine is not superior to the others. So that's one, right?
Right.
Cuisine is Mexican plus Indian plus French plus Italian, European plus non-European, colonized and colonizers, they have to be in a plane of cultural equality. And the second is, that the fact that you are, if you look at the structures of segregation in education, one of the goals was for Mexicans and African Americans and Native Americans and whoever you want, for them to not have access to knowledge at all.
Right.
So whenever you are saying, I'm not going to read X writer, I'm not going to study X scientist, you are saying, I'm going to do the work of the segregationists. Mm. You are not doing this unwittingly, because there's a sense of righteousness in what you're saying, but you have to see how, that the machine is designed for you to segregate yourself out of that knowledge. Yeah.
No, and it's so important, because many times it is important to read those authors simply because the way that they have been pushed onto our knowledge. And if we want to deny them, if we want to take them away from the equation, we have to at least understand them. I always tell my students, in order to destroy the canon, you have to dominate the canon. You have Absolutely. To understand the canon, right?
See, because the understanding here is that however imperfect the knowledge of the past is, the point of every structure of educational inequality is for people in minority positions to not acquire it.
Right.
If you refuse to acquire it yourself, you are already participating on that machine. If you know, there's a thinker, a Mexican thinker from the 40s that I study a lot, and is sort of a guy for me. His name is Alfonso Reyes. Mm-hmm. And he has a lecture called Notes on American Intelligence, and American meant Latin American for him, like America, Latin America, even called America, Latin America, ignoring the U.S. It was really quite something. But he was in this conference in Buenos Aires in front of all the great minds of his time from Europe, from Latin America. And he said, Latin Americans know more than Europeans. Why? Because Europeans only know European knowledge. And Latin Americans know European knowledge and Latin American knowledge. Mm-hmm. So we know more than you, because you wouldn't know, you wouldn't study our knowledge, but we study yours and we study our own. And that is an advantage.
Yeah.
And I think that this model of the critique of appropriation that has emerged in the past few years, understandable because it's trying to fight inequities in the access to voice and platforms, all of which I support, but it has the unintended side effect of losing that edge. If you want to know everything about Chicano culture, that doesn't mean that you shouldn't know African American culture, that you should know white American culture, foreign culture, right? If you want to know about, if you're Latin American, you have to know about India, about Africa. The more you know, the more power you have.
Yeah, and that's so important. That's super, super essential, especially in my classes. I did a class on Latin American landscape, as I mentioned. There's a perception there's no Latin American landscape. Until the 19th century. So what we did is that we borrow from American studies, we borrow from US art history, we borrow from mm-hmm. British art history, we borrow from Nahuatl understanding like the creation of maps. And mm-hmm. we came out with even bigger questions. And that's the important thing, that understanding that knowledge is a construct Mm-hmm. that is contingent to history, then we should be able to, that should push us to learn even from more different cultures, especially in a place like Mexico, where we have African influences in our food, when we have Asian influences in our food. And it's not a 20th century phenomenon. It's a colonial phenomenon. So it is super, super, super important.
Mm-hmm. So if you look at the academic discipline of Mexican studies. That means, for which I mean right now, people who study Mexico, the country, right? Because Mexican, American, and Chicano studies function in a different way.
Right.
They should be joined, really, but they're not. But if you look at that Mexican studies and you see the demographics of students and faculty, you can say that it's roughly half and half. So half Mexican, half non-Mexican. And the half non-Mexican includes Americans, Europeans, South Americans, Asians, right? All over the place. I have been working in that field for 20 years, and I will say that the reason why it's a great field to work with is because it's like that. Mm. Because those of us, I don't think either one of these two groups, you know, there are inequities, imbalances, but I don't think that either one of these two groups has a voice that silences the opposite. Like Mexicans are not strong enough to silence the non-Mexicans and vice versa. And if you start looking at the work, we see different things, because it is not the same to grow up immersed in a culture and looking at it from within than coming from the outside and learning it and then appreciating other things as you learn it and as you acquire it. For me, the fundamental test of whether you are a specialist in Mexico is whether you are a specialist in Mexico, not whether you were born in Mexico. People in Mexico don't know about Mexico sometimes.
Yeah, and I think it is important also to keep that idea that it is an outsider perspective. We're going to learn a lot from that outsider perspective. Yeah. I think the only problem is that when that outsider perspective takes it all, when it appropriates it all, and that's I think, to just to come back, what a lot of people see in some of these white chefs that have that flag of Mexican food in this country.
Well, but if you look at Diana Kennedy, the reason why she has a prominent place is because no one else was doing what she was doing.
Right.
Now, if you see a generation later, and you see the people who are writing about Mexican food now in Mexico, they're mostly Mexicans. But there's such a feeling in part because Diana Kennedy didn't do it by herself, but she helped construct it.
Correct.
And now we have people like Enrique Olvera, like Ricardo Muñoz Zurita, who's a chef and a scholar of Mexican food. You know, we have people in academia working on Mexican food studies. And we have that in part. That work can be done because you can go to Diana Kennedy's work and you can find an archive that wouldn't have been preserved otherwise. So I think that's how you have to measure it. Is what do you give back to the culture that you are working with?
That you're working with, yes.
And how, and what is your contribution? I don't even think that Diana Kennedy or Rick Bayless are original cooks. Like there's not a dish that they invented and they don't even make such a claim.
Right.
What they are is someone that is a very good preservationist and someone who's a very good translator. And that's important work that we do have to recognize for sure.
So with that gesture, I feel sad because I feel like I can talk forever. there's so many Pandora boxes that we open. But I wanted to end the conversation with maybe you have some recommendations for our listeners, the ones that might be interested in further. Complicating these types of figures, because not only in food, we see it everywhere. We see it in art history. There was a recent conversation in art history through a journal of the University of California of what is it to be a brown art historian actually making brown art history as opposed to just white art historians doing Latin American history. And it was a really interesting conversation. So these are things that run everywhere. Is there anything in terms of that authenticity ideas of complicating and not just demonizing it that you could recommend to our listeners?
So I will do two recommendations.
Okay.
One that has to go with the topic of food, because I already mentioned the people who work with NAFTA food and everything. But I think that we have to understand narratives about Mexican food that are not the traditional ones. Mm-hmm. So I will recommend the work of my friend Estefan Igor Ayora Diaz, who's the scholar at the University in Yucatan. Mm-hmm. His book is called Foodscapes, Foodfields, and Identity in Yucatan. And the history of Yucatecan food really complicates a lot our understanding of Mexican food. And that's one of the best books about it. There's particularly probably the best one in English.
Okay.
And then the other thing that I would advise, and I always advise this, is read Mexican and consume Mexican culture that is not about Mexicanness. Like, mm-hmm. Allow Mexicans to speak wildly. And in that sense, there's a Mexican writer that is now available in English, but is also findable in Spanish. His name is Sergio Pitol. Sergio Pitol was a diplomat. He was the ambassador of Mexico in various countries of Eastern Europe for many years, or a cultural attaché. And he has a book called The Journey, or El Viaje in Spanish, which is about his travels through Europe, through Eastern Europe, when he was young. Mm-hmm. And it is a really interesting thing because you will rarely see the perspective, especially in English translation, Mexicans that show their view of other parts of the world.
Right.
I'm actually teaching in the full class of Mexican travelers in history. And there's enormous amounts of writing of Mexicans going to Africa, to the Middle East, you know, to East Asia. But you wouldn't know because it doesn't get translated into English. Because what we translate into English is Mexicans that talk about Mexicanness and authenticity. And I think this is an opportunity to read a Mexican perspective that is also cosmopolitan and global, because I think that complicates the notion of authenticity too.
Yes. So that's as we say, la moraleja, that we, every time there's red flags, people, and this is with everything, every time there's a red flag about something, in the culture, in the call-out culture that we live today in social media, it is always important to more than point fingers, to ask questions and to be critical. We talked about this a lot. It is important to be critical and know where we're coming from. So thank you, Ignacio. Muchísimas gracias. Mm-hmm. I really hope this is the beginning of a long conversation and dialogue about these ideas. There's so much I want to talk to you about, but I have to defend a student in 20 minutes. So I do have to go, but thank you, Sammy. Thank you, Samuel, for our student that connected us. And where can we find you? Where can people follow you?
Well, you can follow me on my Twitter account. It's at @iSanchezPrado. That's probably the best way. And I have a university website too, so.
Perfect. So we'll put those links and the links to the recommendations and the several books and articles we talked about on the website. Ignacio, muchísimas gracias.
Muchas gracias.
Hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
And we're back.
¿Qué tal?
Wow. Dude, I learned a lot. Okay, can I just get right into it?
Let's do it.
I didn't think that this interview would give me a little bit of sympathy towards Rick Bayless, but it kind of did.
Same!
Right? It's just his racist facial hair that does it for me. It's the goatee for me, right? So, like, but learning that he wasn't originally a chef, right? He was an anthropologist.
Well, I see, which makes a lot of sense now.
That makes a lot of sense, because what he's doing is actually translating this culture, right?
Right.
And I found it also fascinating what he talked about, you know, with NAFTA and Maseca, and how that's like, it just like really changed the way that Latin Americans eat in Latin America and in the United States.
Right.
And connected to so many health problems, because all of the, you know, with the industrialization of food everywhere, it just like drains all the nutrients out of it. And we think we're having, you know, people think they're having their regular tortillas from back in the day, but really everything has changed, you know?
Right. And they're
so interesting.
And like, I never thought about it, but one of the things that we talked about off Zoom was, for instance, how in Mexico there's a change when Maseca comes in the early 20th century. Also, when licuadoras are introduced, like that completely changed the way that we eat tortillas, something so basic and simple. And there was a scholar, her name is Aurora Gomez Calvarriato. I tried really hard to get her to do an interview also for this month. But she has a very interesting lecture that you can visit online. Just Google Aurora Gomez Calvarriato, and she talks about the slavery of metate and how there was like a real like quasi-slavery culture behind like people creating and moliendo, you know, the corn, and how that changed, one, the industry of making tortillas, but also the way that we consume it and the products we consume it. Super, super, super interesting. But what I was fascinated about this interview, it's the whole thing with authenticity, because we talk about authenticity a lot in this podcast, but we tend to right away turn off. You're like, ay, este es un gringo a la chingada, you know? But what is authentic food? And that's one of the reasons I enjoy more, because he said the problem is not what they do, because we cannot be so close and be like, nobody can study Mexican food unless you're Mexican, right? Like nobody can study Guatemalteco food unless they're from Guatemala. Like that's not the point. The point is that how they approach the discipline, how they approach these ideas, and just selling everything under the umbrella of, oh, this is authentic food, as opposed to, like, as he said, like Calmex or Tex-Mex or from other parts of the United States, like the Chicano foods, then that's bullshit. And I think that's the biggest problems that we all have with Rick Bayless. Plus, I remember I saw a podcast, an interview with him,
And he's like, I've been discriminated against for being white. That's when I was like, okay, girl, I made a couple of your recipes, pero ya estuvo. Mejor entregate.
Well, he was on, I recommend anybody listening to this to listen to his episode. It was years ago now.
Yeah.
It was a series that Dan Pashman, he does the podcast, The Sporkful.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. It was a series on food and race, and he was on one of them. And because Dan Pashman is white, I think he's white. He's, I don't know. it's a podcast, but judging by what he says, culturally he's white. And so Rick Bayless was kind of being defensive of like, you know, like the same ass argument that all these white people have when you call them out on their privilege, mm-hmm. which is like, yeah, but I also was poor when I grew up. And yeah, right. but I did all of this work. And Dan Pashman being the fucking accomplice, you know, like more than an ally, right? He made him realize, like, he explained to him what white privilege was. He's like, basically like, look, because you're white and because, you know, you come in with all this clout, these people open their doors to you and trust you. And sometimes that's looked at as you're taking advantage of that and you're not realizing like whose stories and whose attempts at doing the same thing you've completely erased. And he still was upset about that. And I think the metaphor he had was like, imagine you're in a classroom. And everybody that's in the classroom is just as qualified as you are, but because you are white, you get a seat at the front row.
Correct.
And your teacher puts a bin in the a trash can in the front row and says, okay, everybody, roll up a piece of paper, ball it up, and let's whoever can make the first basket gets this opportunity. Of course, you're gonna make it because you're sitting right in front of it, but you've worked just as hard as everybody else. And like, do you recognize that? You know, and it made him realize it. And it's crazy. You could hear him realizing it on the microphone.
Yeah,
you know?
And the thing about it is that when you acknowledge your role as an outsider, there's like a real value to that. And people like refuse to do that. Like if you acknowledge your position as somebody that is learning, that you're exposing people to a culture as opposed to like teaching people about a culture, which is two completely different things. There's value to it. Like, again, like there's room for everybody to study everything just because we're Latinos doesn't like, and this is a real question in grad school. I remember that when you, for example, me, I decided to do Mexican art for personal reasons, but there's some people that said, just because I'm Mexican, I don't want to study Mexican art, and you shouldn't have to, you know, the same thing with these people. They're just like, want to study other cultures. That's not a problem. The problem is that you forget your position, you know, because of your white privilege. You completely deny yourself that outsider position, and then you're always in the inside. And the reality is that we need outsider perspectives. You know, we cannot just be in a bubble like that. But it's just el pedo con. And Diana Kennedy's studies, man, and books are pretty fucking impressive. Like, I've gone through some of them, I've seen them, and they're super, 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 super interesting. Pero el pedo es como que ella se cree la dueña de la comida mexicana, y pues that's the problem, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's super.
That's why I'm becoming el dueño de Taco Bell. So I'm taking it back because Guy Bell, like in the interview, it's like Guy Bell didn't give a fuck about Mexican culture. He just profited off of it. And then his iteration or his version of Mexican food is what the world first got to see after the mid-century, you know?
Right.
But he never even gave credit where credit was due. Which, to be fair, I don't think anybody wanted the credit for the hard shell taco, you know? They're like, girl, you can have that, okay? But like, but I don't know, the cheesy cordita crunch, I don't know. You got to give somebody credit for that.
Or the pizza, the taco pizza. ¿Cómo se llama?
Girl, I'm going to have to correct you and give you some sad news, okay? A taco pizza is not a Mexican pizza. So okay. Taco Bell has Mexican pizzas. A taco pizza is commonly served in the Midwest here in the United States of America.
That's right. We talked about it.
In places like Iowa, where I'm going to have an art show, which is basically a pizza with a taco salad on top of it.
Qué desorden.
It's amazing.
Okay. I bet.
Okay. Uh-huh. Even better when there's Doritos on top of it, not just regular chips. Whew. Okay. A Mexican pizza is what Taco Bell has. And guess what, Mimi? I don't know what kind of news you're reading, but you really need to diversify your media, because the Taco Bell Mexican pizza is being discontinued this year. After
what?
This year.
Fuck. Yeah. Okay,
and they already discontinued
the.
No, you don't have to. just zampate una tostada. Yeah.
Zampate.
Sorry, that's what my mom says when she's like, shut up, just shove this in your mouth. But like, just put a toast. Just put shit on a tostada. It's the same thing. No, they also got rid of the cheesy potatoes. So a lot of vegetarians are sad about that.
I'm sorry, guys.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry for your loss. You're just gonna have to go support a local business that isn't evil.
Qué desorden.
Oh my god. But I just hope they don't get rid of the crunch wrap, because in my head, I'm like, they got rid of the Mexican pizza. I get it, because the tostadas break. And, you know, that's why the crunch wrap was invented, because they didn't want to lose money throwing away the broken tostadas from the Mexican pizzas.
Uh-huh.
So the crunch wrap actually is wrapped with broken tostadas, because you don't see the tortilla. You know what I mean?
Speaking of authenticity, I wonder how many people do truly think that when they eat Taco Bell, that's it. Like, that's the authentic, whatever that means, experience.
I cannot imagine anybody really thinks that's Mexican food.
Girl.
I can't imagine.
Like,
I think the closest thing to Mexican food on the menu is a bean burrito. Maybe.
Maybe.
Right?
Maybe from Del Taco.
Del Taco. Girl, I'm not even going to get into Del Taco. I think Del Taco, it tastes like fucking dog food. And yes, I've eaten dog food before, so I know what it tastes like.
Oh, wow. And that's, Fuertes and declaraciones.
And that's Del Taco. Girl, we lived through Y2K, okay? We've been through some things.
You know what? Because, like...
Look, Del Taco's fine. I know there's a lot of stands out on the West Coast for Del Taco. And it's, like, more locally owned. Wada Wada La Cuchara. Okay. The only thing there that's good is they have the Beyond Meat, so you can have vegan shit, and then the fish tacos are bomb.net. That's it. Okay, go ahead.
But I'm questioning this because, like, I saw this documentary last night that fucked me up, and I was like, fuck. Okay, so I guess I've been living in a bubble. It's from PBS. It's about the Ark. It's called the Ark Encounter Site. Have you heard about it?
The Ark? What do you mean? La Arca de Noé? Okay.
Yes, they recreated it in Kentucky. It's like,
see, this is what I'm talking about. White people whiting. They recreated La Arca de Noé, and there's like no fucking money for education. Like, there's
that was the whole thing.
We got 12. How many millions of dollars did the government give to them to fund this fucking Arca de Noé?
You can't even
get a second stimulus check. Okay, go ahead.
Dude, you gotta watch it, because that's the whole thing. They use even dinosaurs. They said that they were... La Arca de Noé es como el nacimiento de tu abuelita. There's like dinosaurs inside of the Arca de Noé, and they said that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. There's sections of the Arca where like... They tell you how the Grand Canyon was formed, which apparently it's only 6,000 years old, and it's a result of the flood, that you have the formation of all those colors and all those rocks
But do the scientists like know that it's funny, or
they
are
have
they serious?
Fucking PhD people like backing but this stuff up.
But they're trying to create it as if it was real, as if like myths are real, but they know that it's not.
No. I don't give them the benefit of the doubt, so I'm sure they don't. I don't know. Who knows? But the whole point behind this theme park, because it's going to become a Bible theme park, it's because it's growing and growing because it's doing so good. It's to prove that everything in the Bible can be scientifically proven. Dude, you gotta watch it. I was flipping.
Well, girl,
I couldn't believe it. And the thing is that Kirsten Buick, shout out my professor in UNM, she always starts her landscape U.S. landscape classes talking about this theme park, because the idea of land expansion is always tied to religion. So she's basically saying this shed, it's not ending. There's millions of dollars going into the funding on places like this. So this is how she starts her classes. And then she talks about landscape in the colonial period, the 19th century, 20th century with land artists, et cetera, et cetera. And that, so I've all the references I have about the Ark Encounter Park is through her. And I finally saw it yesterday. Mm. And I was like, if there's people that believe that Noé se llevó unos cuantos dinosaurios, and they say, by the way, they were babies because otherwise they couldn't fit in the ark.
they were eggs.
Exactly. They're like, but the eggs do fit in the ark. So if people believe that shit, then there's got to be people that believe that Taco Bell is real Mexican food. Who knows?
That's where you went?
Yes.
With that?
That's what I was thinking last night when I was watching this shit.
Do you have the address to that? That theme park?
Just, it's in Williamstown, Kentucky.
Okay, porque les voy a mandar un riñón a ver lo que pueden hacer con eso.
That's funny. Ay, ay, ay. So, like, I guess that's going to be one of my recommendations this week, to watch it on PBS, because it's, when you watch that, you realize that what may seem like maybe a joke, as a post on Facebook that people talk about this shit and they joke about it. How can people believe in this stuff? It's so real, you know? And these things they may, you know, that we may not take seriously are affecting entire communities.
Yeah.
It's so fucked up. It's called I found it. It's called We Believe in Dinosaurs, a real arc for a real flood. Just so you can.
You know, there's a creationist display right by where you are in Cabazon.
I'm sure. I can't.
Where those people turned that dinosaur display to like a creationist museum.
There's like a whole visual culture of dinosaurs. The whole thing that you always see them in sites where they're like Native American sites around the road, for instance. It's because they equate Native American cultures as primitive culture. So there's always this like dinosaur fantasies all over the Southwest specifically.
Mm-hmm. Bitch. I gotta tell you something.
Dime.
So, you know, I'm still watching Survivor.
Uh-huh.
Because somehow we're still in quarantine, and I said I would watch Survivor every day of a quarantine.
Oh, my God.
I'm already on season 11 or 12, I think. But I think one of those seasons, I just finished one of those seasons, and it was Survivor Guatemala.
Right.
The Maya Empire.
Hijo su madre.
Guess where these motherfuckers were doing the show. Guess where the tribes, they call them tribes, right? Guess where the tribes had to survive in Guatemala?
No sé, güey. No tengo ni la menor idea.
Guess. Take a guess of where they were. Just take one guess.
I don't know. In Tikal?
They were fucking surviving in Tikal. Like, using the ruins as their shelters.
Hijo de... No mames, güey. Speaking of white privilege.
We got to do a whole episode on it because I have a lot of things to say. Because I was just in Tikal last year, and this season of Survivor, you know, it's the illusion that they're like in the middle of nowhere. Like, okay, Tikal is in a fucking national forest. There's a lot of jungle around it. But also when I was watching it, I was like, I know that behind those trees over there is a snack shack and a restaurant. And you guys are pretending that you're in the middle of nowhere. Like, or like the lake that they would go have fun. And I was like, I know that down the street, like there's a road behind those trees. That's, you know, like it's so fake. It's so fake. But what gagged me, like the North Acropolis, which is this like gathering of pyramids in Tikal, mm-hmm. They used it as a set for their tribal council, like when they vote people off. And they just used it as a set, like put all these torches, lit that shit on fire, like they didn't give a fuck. And so I know that they had to close the national park down for them to shoot that in like the month that they were there. Like, damn, that's crazy.
But see, like speaking of,
but I think
speaking of authenticity, like those shots read as authentic, even though you're talking about a precious religious center that was like part of such a vast and incredibly important empire for the development of fucking human civilization. And it comes down to that, to an authentic site for a fucking reality TV show.
Yeah, yeah, you know,
ya vamos a entregarnos a la chingada.
And you know, I wish I would have been on that season because I would have won. These hoes were like, oh my God, the monkeys are so loud. I was like, yeah, bitch, I've been there. And your shelter is actually nicer than when I went to my uncle's farm and had to sleep in a fucking hamaca in the middle of the fucking forest.
Hijo su madre.
Ay, no. Ay, Dios mío.
Anyway,
it's this notion of authenticity that we're obsessed with. And then also like these, like, you know, there's a lot of conversations about these culture vultures. And like, I think because Rick Bayless is so defensive, like he's, and so white, like he's a big target for a lot of people. And it's also like his power as like a cis man, you know, like,
right.
I think a lot of women are kind of given a pass a lot of times when it comes to this, because when it comes to food, you know, they're like, because like Rick Bayless, it's so messed up, like in the food industry or like in the, you know, the fine dining world, like women are often looked as like cooks and like, you know, hi, I'm Rachel Ray or whatever.
Yeah,
but then
hosts
like
hosts and shit, yeah.
But then like whatever. Then whoever, even if, speaking of culture vulture, like Bobby Flay, like, oh, a chef, you know, like there's these distinctions between cook and chef, and I don't know. There's a lot of layers to this. I don't know what I'm babbling about now, but it was interesting, the points that you guys brought up during that conversation. It gave me a lot to think about.
Yeah, me too. I did not expect that. That was like a lesson learned, because I was expecting this other Mexa to come and just shit on them. But you know, it's important. It's important to have these conversations before just pointing the finger, because it's so easy for our generation and the future generations on this politically correct, you know, like era, to just point the finger and walk away, you know, because we're so much better than everybody else, apparently. But the reality is always so much more complicated. Not to say that I'm running to support any of his businesses, especially since he said in Chicago, I'm not going to do that. But now I have a different perspective, and now I feel like I can have a conversation about it in a completely different way, you know, because it is also conversations that we have in academia, because my field is filled with white people. And that was like a whole journal dedicated last year about that. They actually, like, I wrote an essay about what is it to be Mexican and study Mexican art. What a fucking concept, you know what I mean? So it's complicated, but I'm glad that these conversations are being had, and I'm glad that we get to have a space like that. So thank you so much to Ignacio Sanchez Prado, because you, like, really, I really thought about that conversation to this day, and that happened a while ago. But anyway, do you have any recommendations before we go?
Rest in peace to the Mexican pizza. 2020. It's been a tough year.
That's the hardest.
It just keeps getting tougher. It's actually been a really rough time. Not just because of the Mexican pizza. So my recommendation is for everybody to just take care of themselves and really, I don't know. I feel like now this pandemic, like we're, it's like, first of all, we're like in such a capitalist place, right? Like,
right.
Okay, you just got to tough it out, put on a mask and go on with your day. But I feel like we're expected to perform right now and not really, and just pretend that this is the new normal, which it is, I guess. But like, I don't know. This shit ain't normal, y'all. And if you guys feel sad and don't feel like doing things and feel like all this pressure to get work done, I say fuck that. Like, this is not normal. We're living through, you know, like when you're in history class and you're like learning about World War II or like the Holocaust, and you're like, oh my God, it must have been nuts. Like, how would it have been to be in Germany at that time and just, right, like living in just day to day. It's like we're doing that right now, but we don't realize it because we're living through history. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like,
it's
like so many people look are in back survival in mode. Like we have no idea. It's so crazy.
We're living through a time right now where we're going to look back and we're like, can you believe there was concentration camps in the United States and we were just sitting there doing nothing? There was black people being murdered in plain daylight, mm-hmm. being videotaped, mm-hmm. being lynched, and their images were being shared on social media platforms like it was nothing. Do you remember we were in a time where, like, there was I'm sorry, this may be triggering for people, so trigger warning. But there, we're in a time where there's just like kids being sex trafficked openly, multiple documentaries about it, and nothing is being done about it. Remember there, you know, like I can just keep going. Remember the time when they, when Taco Bell discontinued the Mexican pizza, and we just sat there and did nothing, right? Remember when? So it just like keeps going and going, and I'm just like, this is how desensitized we have. We've gotten as a country,
yep.
as a world, yep. mm-hmm. that I think we just need to step back and really, like, I don't know, like get some perspective, but I don't really know how to do that right now.
It's very difficult. I think the only thing that I can think about, which is what I told my students when all this shit started, like you have to use this time to reevaluate a lot of things. And get tougher, man, because as I said in the last episode, it's necessary, but it's going to be painful and it's going to seem like things are going to shit. It's happening, right? But at the same time, the empire is getting stronger. Like it is. Like things are getting tuned. And instead, we're like stuck at home. So like we like shout out to all those people that don't give up and they keep protesting. They keep going out there and fighting and fighting and fighting. And we all have our ways to fight, but you have to, like, I'm sorry. It's the new normal. It's resistance, especially for our communities. So for one second you let the guard down, va a valer madre.
But that's also coming. That's also something like very privileged for us to be able to say, for like you to say, like, there's some of us that, like, my mom has to go clean bathrooms for people that don't believe that there is a coronavirus, that it's a hoax. And she's putting her life at risk every day.
And
so
that's a
what?
Form of, like, resistance right there.
Or is she just surviving?
It's both, man, because you got to do, you got to feed your family. You got to feed your loved ones. You got to do it. You know what I mean?
I don't know. I don't see it that way. I see it as, like, we're really fucked up as a society to let my mom go to work right now. Like, we should be taking care of her. True. We should be taking care of ourselves. Like, it's not an act of heroism. It's disparity. It's like, it's the only thing we can do. So, like, I don't know. That's like, I appreciate that sentiment, Babs, but it's like too romantic for me. It's like, we need to take care of each other, but instead we shape it like we're moving fucking mountains. And like, no, we're not. Just put a fucking mask on and stay the fuck home because you care about other
it's
people.
It's tan difícil, güey. It's tan difícil for some fucking people to just do that.
Yeah, some people. And it's just like, it's heartbreaking. And I'm at the point, like, and the holidays are coming up. And I'm like, I don't want to have arguments with my family because I know they're not going to be wearing masks at our get-togethers and they're going to think that I'm overreacting. So I'm like, I'm already not going to go to Thanksgiving and Christmas because I don't want to have... I don't want to be that person.
Right.
And by me not showing up, that'll be my statement. You know what I mean? Right. And it's like, I don't know. And so this is going to change our lives forever. I mean, it already has.
Yeah.
But like the way that we interact with our family and that the way that people are talking about this too, it's just like opened my eyes to be like, oh, you really, like some of my family members, like, oh, you really don't give a shit about anybody but you. And like your immediate family.
They like, don't. Like, there's people having quinceañeras right now. I know somebody.
Y'all don't give a fuck.
I'm not going to say who.
Hello. This weekend, my cousin's having a bachelor party in San Diego. And he seriously asked me if I was coming. And I'm like, are you fucking... Oof. I'm going to calm down. Anyway.
You know what can help you get your anger out at least momentarily?
Make fun of you. It works every time.
Besides making fun of me.
What?
It's Rita Indiana's new album.
Oh, bitch, what a segue. Look at you.
Bitch.
We're going to call you Segway King. You're like a mall cop, bitch.
Yeah. What? The album Bob is Lark. Called Mandinga Times. And there's a really good interview by Isabella Herrera in Pitchfork. It's called The Return of Ritendiana, singular icon of Dominican music. They know her in the Dominican Republic as La Montra, as La Mostra, you know, like the monster. And this album, which was produced by Visitante from Calle 13, has Ruben Albarrán from Café Tacuba. It's our fucking roller coaster. It's so, so good. I love the first album, El Juidero de Rita Indiana, but she can do no wrong. And this album is on repeat right now. And it's what we need, man. She started talking about how everything seemed like the end of the world. And she started writing this album before everything started. So this is a confirmation that everything that is happening right now is just amplified. But like, as we've been saying, like people have been surviving and they try to survive and they've been resisting for a long, long, long fucking time. And there's people that are able to articulate that artistically. So shout out to Rita Indiana because it is an amazing album. Again, the album is Mandinga Times. And that's my recommendation for this week because it's too good. And the last time she came out with an album, it was in 2010. So it's been 10 years. So ya salió la música de Rita Indiana, ya nos podemos ir todos.
Damn, 10 years?
10 years, man, because she came out with this album and it was overwhelming. Like nobody was doing anything like that. Now we have Mula, we have like the whole entire, not that nobody was doing that, it's just that they were not in the forefront. People were not listening to that stuff in the States. Mm-hmm. So she came out and there was like a door open of all this Caribbean experimental cool stuff that started to happen, you know? And she got overwhelmed and it was too much fame. So she went back and then she started working again on her novels. And she's known, like in 2015, she came out with a novel called La Mucama de Ominkunle. And it's their novels about, it's science fiction. It's Caribbean science fiction is what it is. And cool. It's so, and it's like queer. It's so badass. She's so amazing. So she wrote all these books. She got all these awards, literary awards. She became this voice of an entire generation. And because everything is such a mess, she decided to once again come back and start making music again. And again, oh, it's so, so good. So, so good. Such a good album. You can find it anywhere.
Cool.
And that's it.
Great. As always, you can reach us at latinoswholunch.com. Also, leave us a review. If you can, 5 stars.
5 estrellas solamente.
Because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are. And
visibility leads to representation, and representation matters.
Today's episode was produced by Justin Favela and Emmanuel Ortega with production assistance by Maite Sosa. The music you're hearing now is by the band Balloon. I'm Favi Fav.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.
Ciao, ciao, ciao.